Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Jim Tedder. Jill Robbins joins us today to teach us English and then inform us about some special satellites that are designed to help developing countries. We have a lot of work to do, so let's hear first about some unusual but important words that we all need to know. Jill?
One fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish, goes the Dr. Seuss children's story. Why isn't it two fishes? You may think,
okay, it's hard to count fish, so we group them all together. No problem.
It's easy to understand that farmers would not worry about making plurals when they talk about sheep. After all, they are almost always in a group. When you have one sheep, you can also call it a ram or a ewe, and make those nouns plural by adding an S, rams and ewes. Let's look at some other things we can make plural. You've got a left foot and a right foot. Put them together, and what have you got? 2 feet. That doesn't follow the add an S rule either. Same with mouse, and it's plural, mice. What happened to our neat rule for making words plural? The answer is in our history. English came from German roots. German grammar changes the vowel sound in the middle of the word to show it is plural. The plural form of the German word for goose, Gans, is Gänse. The vowel with 2 dots over it is called an umlaut, so goose becomes geese in English. There are other plurals where the vowel changes, like in the German pattern. Man, men, and woman, women are examples of different vowel sounds in plural words. Sometimes a consonant changes, as with words that end in an F sound, such as leaf. The voiceless sound F takes on a voiced quality, or V, and an S sound is added to the word. We have autumn leaves and sharp knives. Another way to make plurals in English is to add the suffix en or n. We see this in the words brother, brethren, child, children, and ox, oxen. These are words that come from Old English. With words that come from foreign languages, there are some patterns that may help you remember the plural. Many technical words in English came from Latin. Let's look at the plural of some words from Latin. Words that end in US drop that ending and add I to become plural, as in fungus, fungi, and cactus, cacti. Listen to this conversation. What is that orange thing in the tree?
It's a fungus. There are a lot of different fungi in the forest.
For words that end in UM, the ending changes to A, as in the words datum, data, and medium, media. These two words are more common in their plural forms than the singular forms in our digital life. Listen to how the words medium and media appear in this conversation. I heard you got a job at the New York Times.
Yeah, I'm glad to be working in mass media.
But newspapers are a dying medium, aren't they?
Hey, I hope not. I'm writing a blog for them.
When a word from Latin ends in EX or IX, the plural ending is ICES. This results in index, indices, and matrix, matrices. Here's another conversation. The financial news is bad. The Dow Jones Index is down.
Don't worry. There are other indices, like employment, going up.
Are you ready to try making plurals with some English words? Use the Germanic pattern for these words.
Tooth.
Is your answer teeth?
Wolf.
Is your answer wolves? Use the Latin pattern for these words.
Memorandum.
Your answer should be memoranda.
Focus.
Your answer should be foci. There are many more irregular plural forms in English. We'll look at those in another episode of Everyday Grammar.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Satellite technology is the newest tool for helping developing countries deal with climate change and natural disasters. Satellites can measure conditions on the ground and share the data with communities. A partnership between the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the U.S. Agency for International Development has invented such a system called SERVIR. Once again, here's Jill.
SERVIR captures images and environmental data, like dangerous weather and changes in water resource use. Scientists feed that information into complex computer programs. The results of the analysis are shared with people living in the affected areas, as well as governments and organizations, to help them react and prepare. Dan Irwin is the director of the NASA SERVIR Coordination Office. He told VOA Learning English that the SERVIR project shares important information with countries all over the world.
So the main goal of SERVIR really is taking space-based information and making it available to people around the world so they can really address issues that they have in their countries, whether it be deforestation, air quality, and bringing it down to village and making it available to people for better decision-making. We need to be able to convert that data to address the cares and concerns that countries have around the world. And as NASA, we can work with countries, but it's then how do we take it even further? How do we go from space to country, down to state or provincial level, down to the village level?
Jennifer Frankel Reed is the Senior Climate Change Specialist for USAID. She explained how SERVIR has helped warn Bangladeshis of flooding and prevented people in El Salvador from eating unsafe seafood. In Kenya, which depends heavily on tea farming, farmers have avoided losing crops to rising temperatures.
The idea is that through our local partnerships with hubs, we can bring that data, analyze it in ways that people can use, translate it into easy-to-use formats, and then help people with the decisions that those data inform.
Developed in 2004, SERVIR brought together the U.S. agencies with the World Bank and Central American Commission on Environment and Development. The first hub was established in Panama in 2005, but was closed in 2011. Other hubs were established in Kenya, Nepal, and Thailand between 2008 and 2014. Both Mr. Irwin and Ms. Frankel Reed said the project's goal was to empower people with information to help them grow.
We hope to continue to expand, but ultimately and absolutely the most important thing about SERVIR is enabling amazing people around the world.
The project now operates in more than 30 countries. I'm Jill Robbins.
This is VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The number of overweight children in the U.S. is growing. That is the reason the American Heart Association and the Clinton Foundation created the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. Over the past 10 years, the Alliance has been coming up with creative ways to fight childhood obesity. One of these ways is inviting young people to be part of the solution. 12-year-old Jody Evans has always been active. She loves to exercise and play sports, including dancing.
Well, dancing is a sport. Not everybody thinks it's a sport just because it's just not in the Olympics. But it's something that keeps your heart rate going. It's something that requires a lot of energy. It's something that requires eating healthy to have energy.
Jody is on the Alliance for a Healthier Generation's Youth Advisory Board. The Alliance chose her for her healthy lifestyle and her involvement in sports. Megan McIntyre is spokeswoman for the Alliance. She says the young people in the Alliance are sharing their viewpoint or perspective on how to fight childhood obesity.
They all are raising their voice on this issue and giving their perspective on how to combat childhood obesity. And on top of that, they're making a difference in their own communities. So they're having tremendous impact all across the country on issues that they care about, and they choose how they really want to make an impact.
Tomatoes. Do you eat potatoes?
And more importantly, the young Alliance members talk about making healthier food choices with their friends. Ms. McIntyre says this is very important. Talking with friends will help to change the current shocking obesity numbers. Again, here is Ms. McIntyre.
1 in 3 children are overweight or obese. And some research out there suggests that this could be the first generation that doesn't outlive their parents.
The goal of the Alliance is to empower children to create healthier environments for themselves. Ms. McIntyre says they are doing this by increasing physical activity throughout and after the school day. The Young Alliance members are also bringing healthier food choices to where students eat and buy food. June Evans is Jody's mom. She says serving on the Youth Advisory Board has helped her daughter learn about the issue of obesity. It has also helped her to develop important leadership skills.
If she sees, you know, friends that are struggling in an area where they're not eating healthy or they're complaining about their body or they're complaining about their weight, she will step in and she'll do it in a positive, quiet way.
Jody has a gentle, friendly approach. This makes it easy for Melissa Jackson and her other friends to listen to what she has to say.
She told me that our body is a temple and we should take care of that temple by eating right, taking care of our body, exercising properly.
Jody's term on the board ends this year, but she says she will always stay active. She also plans to continue to spread the message of staying active and eating healthy among her friends in school, in her neighborhood, and everywhere. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thank you.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we talk about the election of 1828. It was bitter and full of angry words and accusations. The old Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson had split into two opposing groups. President John Quincy Adams led one of the groups. It called itself the National Republican Party. Andrew Jackson, a military hero and politician, led the other group. It called itself the Democratic Party. Each party had its own newspapers. In Washington, the Daily National Journal supported President Adams. The United States Telegraph supported General Jackson. The Telegraph published accusations by Democrats in Congress against the administration. The Journal, in turn, published a pamphlet that said Jackson had fought a man, chased him away like a dog, and then stolen his wife. Jackson denied these claims. Historians still do not know how much of this story is true, but the story had a great effect on Jackson for the rest of his life. Jackson met the young woman, Rachel, at her mother's home near Nashville, Tennessee. Rachel and her husband, Louis Robards, were living there at the time. They were having marriage problems. Robards argued with his wife about Jackson. He said she and Jackson seemed too close. Robards reportedly wanted to fight Jackson with his fists. Jackson said he would face Robards not in a fist fight, but in a gunfight if Robards wished to fight like a gentleman. Robards rejected the invitation to a duel, and nothing more happened between the two men. Robards and his wife settled their differences, but a short time later, they had another dispute, and Rachel left. Court records said she left with a man, Andrew Jackson. Rachel's family said she told Robards she wanted a divorce. They said he threatened her, telling her he would carry her away by force. So Rachel's family said she decided to flee. She decided to go with some traders to Natchez in the dangerous Mississippi Territory. By now, Rachel meant a great deal to Andrew Jackson. He had fallen in love with her. When the traders asked him to go with them to Natchez to protect them, he agreed. The group left for the territory early in 1791. For his part, Louis Robards began preparations for a divorce. He allowed Rachel's family to believe that he and Rachel were no longer married. But in fact, he did not complete the necessary legal action to make the divorce final. Jackson returned from Natchez after several months. His opponents later claimed that he had married Rachel while in Natchez. They said she was still another man's wife at the time. Opponents said the couple's relationship was both immoral and illegal. They said Jackson was an adulterer for having a relationship with a married woman. And they said Rachel was a bigamist for having two husbands. But Jackson said he believed Rachel and her first husband, Louis Robards, were divorced. He said he returned to Nashville to ask Rachel's mother for permission to marry her daughter and that she agreed. Andrew and Rachel Jackson remained in Tennessee. The next 2 years were busy for Jackson. As a young lawyer, he worked hard and traveled far. Then in December 1793, Jackson said he discovered court papers showing that Louis Robards had only recently divorced Rachel. Jackson said he was shocked. As soon as possible, he and Rachel were married again, legally this time. Almost 10 years passed. Jackson became a judge and got involved in Tennessee politics. But the circumstances of his marriage remained an issue that led to arguments. For instance, a man once accused Jackson of cheating on a horse racing bet. Then the man called his wife a bigamist. Jackson killed the man in a duel. Later, in the 1828 presidential election, Jackson's opponents made Rachel's honor a campaign issue. Jackson could not duel everyone who questioned his wife's honor, so he asked a special committee of citizens to investigate his marriage and make a public report. Many people on the committee were his friends or supporters. The committee found that the Jacksons were not at fault for getting married before Rachel and her first husband were legally divorced. The pro-Jackson newspaper in Washington published the committee's report. Pro-Jackson papers also began to print vicious stories about President Adams and his wife. Anti-Jackson newspapers did not publish the committee's report. They continued to denounce the Jacksons' marriage. Historian Daniel Feller at the University of Tennessee is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He says the charges about Jackson's marriage made a good story for people to talk about. But, he says, other accusations were more serious. These were about Jackson's career.
The attacks that really hit home were about Jackson's unauthorized and perhaps directly against orders conquest of Florida in 1819, his sometimes savage disciplinary measures against his own troops, his declaring martial law in New Orleans and maintaining martial law in New Orleans and arresting people in New Orleans well after the War of 1812 was actually over.
All during the bitter election campaign, neither Jackson nor his opponent, President Adams, said anything about one very important issue, slavery. Adams did not want to lose what little support he had in the South and West by denouncing slavery. Jackson did not want to lose the support of some Republicans in the North by openly defending it. Adams's silence did not mean that he approved of slavery. Southerners were sure that he opposed it, and Jackson did not have to tell the South what he thought about slavery. He was a slave owner, and he had bought and sold slaves all his life. There was another important difference between the two men and their political parties. President Adams and the Republicans represented the interests of those who owned property. Many of the president's supporters felt that wealthy, property-owning citizens should control the government. Jackson and the Democrats represented the interests of the common people. They did not feel that the rich had more right to govern than the poor. The presidential election of 1828 was held on different days in the different states between October 31st and November 5th. Voters in the northern states supported John Quincy Adams. Andrew Jackson won the South. Historian Daniel Feller says Southerners did not seem bothered by opponents' fears that Jackson was mentally unstable and believed he should have unlimited power.
They were much more compelled by the image of this great man of the people and also this great man on horseback, the hero of New Orleans.
Even President Adams recognized that Jackson was extremely well-liked.
John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary years before the election that in a popularity contest, in a political contest, no man could stand against the hero of New Orleans.
When the electoral votes were counted, Andrew Jackson received 178. President Adams received only 83. Rachel Jackson was proud of her husband, but she was not happy about the life she would have to lead as First Lady, and her health seemed to be suffering. For Mr. Jackson's sake, she said, I am glad. For my own part, I never wished it. Nevertheless, the couple prepared to move to Washington. There was little time for Rachel to rest. Then, just a few days before the Jacksons were to move, two doctors were called to the Jackson home. They found Rachel in great pain. She seemed to be having a heart attack. After a day or so, she appeared to be better. She was able to sit up and talk with friends, but her mind was still troubled about the years ahead in Washington. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God, she said, than to dwell in that palace in Washington. She was referring to the presidential mansion, later known as the White House. In December of 1828, a few nights before Christmas, Rachel was sitting in a chair. Her husband had already gone to sleep. Suddenly, Rachel cried out and fell to the floor. The servants screamed. Jackson ran to the room, picked Rachel up, and carried her to the bed. But he could see that life had already left her. Witnesses said Jackson continued to sit next to her, holding his head in his hands. Rachel was buried 2 days later. 10,000 people went to the funeral. The Reverend William Hume spoke of Rachel Jackson's life. He talked of her kindness and humility, and he told how she had been upset about the personal accusations against her during the election campaign. Jackson believed those accusations were a cause of Rachel's death. His anger is expressed on the stone above Rachel's grave. One line of the inscription says, "A being so gentle and so virtuous, slander might wound, but could not dishonor." At that time, Andrew Jackson was 61 years old. He was a tall, thin man. His long face was wrinkled. Most portraits of him show a great mass of messy hair pushed back from his high forehead. Jackson's health had never really been good. He carried in his body two bullets from duels fought years before. But he was a tough man, with a spirit strong enough to keep moving, even when he was grieving. He left for Washington in January 1829. A huge crowd was gathering there to meet him. They would create one of the wildest inaugural celebrations in American history. And that will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.